Monitor 67, with the best sound around for your weekend listening. Just ahead, we'll be hearing from Skitch Henderson, Jimmy Dean, and Ralph Carmichael, an interview with actor James Mason, and an exchange between Arlene Francis and Anthony Perkins on the subject of food in the various countries where movies are made. All this and music, too, in the hour just ahead. So, join us, won't you? I'm your host, Brad Crandall. And starting off this half hour with monitor music, let's hear from Skitch Henderson and his orchestra with All.
Personal regards, sincerely, etc., etc. Now read that back to me, Miss Jones.
Miss Jones.
When you can't afford to be dull, sharpen your wits with No-Doze. No-Doze Keep Alert tablets or new chewable mints, safe as coffee, help you become more naturally alert to people and conditions around you.
Sharpen your wits with No-Doze. No-Doze keeps you alert.
Hmm? Oh, some years ago, a young architecture student at England's Cambridge University decided to forsake his drawing board and take up the profession of acting. Now, many of today's movie fans are kind of glad that James Mason did decide to become an actor, and he is, too, as he told reporter Johnny Andrews.
James Mason plays the pivotal role of Charles Dobbs in The Deadly Affair, John le Carré's first suspense novel, in Technicolor, and it looks like James Mason has done it again. Mr. Mason, how many films have you starred in up to now?
Well, I've made about 80 films, I suppose. You just said, I heard you say that that was John le Carré's first
suspense
story,
was it? Produced in Technicolor. It wasn't his first.
First John le Carré thing produced in Technicolor.
In Technicolor,
you know, there's a thing nowadays, unfortunately. You have to make all your films in color. Because television demands color. And television is a very large item nowadays in the sale of films. And it's not all films that really ask to be made in color. You know, John le Carré's spy stories are rather downbeat, and it's set in London. And the director, you remember they made an earlier picture. The spy who came in from the cold,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Which was photographed in bleak black and white. And it created just the right atmosphere for this type of a spy film. And you really couldn't go better than that in terms of photographic atmosphere. And I think that Sidney Lumet, who directed and produced the picture, accepted the idea of doing it in color rather reluctantly. However, we had the greatest color cameraman now living, Freddie Young, who's got a couple of Oscars, one for Lawrence of Arabia and the other for Dr. Zhivago. He was doing the job. And he was briefed by Sidney Lumet to figure out a way of making the color unobtrusive so that it would not detract, not make it too colorful. And he figured out a way. I think it involved pre-exposing the film up to a certain degree before they actually used it in the camera. It's one of the reasons why you get a good color atmosphere without losing the bleak black and white effect.
Back in the days in Huddersfield, Yorkshire, as a small boy, did you intend to be an actor?
No. I didn't think about it a great deal. While I was at school, I went along with my father's wishes. He wanted me to be some sort of a superior civil servant. However, I finally became independent to the point of having ambitions of my own. And when I went to Cambridge University, I switched into studying architecture. And I wanted very much to be an architect, but unfortunately, there were rather grim days. I'm talking about 1930, 1931. And so, having had some success in amateur productions, in fact, having really had my first success that I was conscious of, so I thought, that's the way I shall try and make my living. I think I can do it that way.
I'm glad you did. I'm sure I voice the opinions of many. What about Huddersfield? What kind of a town was it? Do you ever get back there? Do you remember?
Yes, I do.
Kids?
I go frequently because my father and mother are still living.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a brother and his family living on the other side of the town. And I go there two or three times a year. And I like it. I was there only about 10 days ago. I like it very much. I wanted very much to get out of it when I was a kid, because at that time it was a bleak, a rather depressed industrial area, very black, because there was lots of mill chimneys pouring out filthy smoke. And if you went out as kids and touched a tree or a wall, you know, you were black immediately. But now, but after, you know, I was no longer condemned to live there, when there was the remittance of sentence, you might say. Now, then I began to be responsive to its charm. And it's charming. It's a sort of charming area. You have these black industrial cities like Huddersfield, Bradford, Halifax, places like that. And they meet on the outskirts. The ground rises rather steeply, and you get onto these moors, which immediately suggest the Brontes. As a matter of fact, Bronte land is just over them. It only takes me about, half an hour to drive to Haworth, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
From where we are. I like it very much.
Now, is there any one thing you want to do in the future that you haven't done up to now, whether it be in motion pictures or otherwise?
No, I don't want to. No, I can't say that. I just want to go on making. I'm very enthusiastic about films, more than anything else in show business. People say, sometimes with a look of dismay, they look at me and say, "Don't you ever want to do a play in the theater?" As if I was missing some sort of glory or respectability by this failure on my part. But I don't think that it is any longer a mark of superiority to be a stage actor, because I think that the films that one is allowed to see nowadays are just as interesting, if not more, from an artistic point of view, than the stage plays that one sees.
Mr. James Mason, our sincere thanks, and I look forward to The Deadly Affair. James Mason, playing the role of Charles Dobbs. The very best of health and good luck to you, sir.
Thank you very much indeed. I've enjoyed being with you.
This is Johnny Andrews for Monitor.
You're tuned to Monitor at 17 minutes after the hour. Just ahead, Arlene Francis interviews actor Tony Perkins. So stay with us. You're on the Monitor.
Oh, when I'm lonely, I think of someone. Someone I call sweet misery. In her arms I was in heaven, but heaven wasn't meant for me. Ooh, I still love her. Ooh, but I lost her. When she walked out, the hurt walked in. Now our love's gone, just like an old song that no one ever wants to hear again. I count heartaches that a big boo makes, and I think about my sweet misery. I do my sorrow each new tomorrow. Who's they ain't never been a bigger fool than me.
In case you just joined us, let's identify ourselves. You're listening to Next on Monitor, Arlene Francis, brought to you by Orlon 33 Acrylic, the DuPont fiber that never gets tired, and James Lee's Carpets. Here's Arlene.
In 1 minute, my guest will be Tony Perkins, star of The Star-Spangled Girl. You've probably heard me talk before about Lee's cushy carpets made with pile of Orlon 33 acrylic by DuPont. But did I tell you about the five different textures? The loop pile and the twist and the plush and the two elegant sculptures? Well, Lee's has them all, you know, at their springy, lively Orlon 33 best.
Springier, fancier, it's the carpet fiber that's livelier.
Springier, livelier, made by DuPont,
it's Orlon 33.
When you look at Lee's full house of textures in carpets made with Orlon 33 acrylic, be sure to give them the touch test. Your bare toe will tell you how much springier, livelier, plushier these heavenly carpets by Lee's really are.
Springier, livelier, made by DuPont,
it's Orlon 33.
Tony Perkins, actors and athletes are often the most finicky eaters in the world. Do you fit into the finicky star category?
No. I grew up in New England, where feeding and eating habits for children are extremely ordinary. It's very plain food, not spicy, not elegant. As a result, I learned to eat almost anything.
Were you a child that was persuaded to eat something? I mean, if you didn't want to
eat on the head?
You know, very often the parents...
No, I like all kinds of vegetables. I mean, even the much dreaded and joked about Brussels sprouts.
I do, too.
Delicious.
I'm keen about them, yeah. Do you like any particularly exotic foods at all?
I like all Japanese food, because it's so simply cooked. You know, it's very kind of underprepared, if you like. They don't know what the word sauce means. It's all
soy sauce.
Well, soy sauce, but that's hardly a gravy or a sauce. It's
that's
just
right.
A kind of seasoning. And I guess relatively few Americans know much about Japanese cooking, but I would say almost none know that there are several different kinds of Japanese cooking. I mean, sukiyaki, for instance, is only a small part
yes,
of the
Japanese
cooking.
Yes, it's the one that's
cooking.
Best known
right.
here, though.
Mm-hmm. I suppose like hot dogs would be to Ethiopians. But I like all Japanese cooking. It's utterly simple and uncluttered and uncomplicated.
I think that part of it is true, but I did find that because fishes use so much
mm-hmm.
raw fish as well as all other kinds of fish.
I don't dig that.
That all the other foods took on the flavor of the fish. You know, I'd
really?
See a marvelous bowl of strawberries at the Imperial Hotel, and I'd say, oh, can't wait, and it was like a mouthful of mackerel.
Gee, I didn't have that.
Well, when you were working on films in other countries, that's Japan, that's one. What other countries Well, can you remember where you enjoyed the food?
Well, I'll tell you where I did not enjoy it, and that is in Australia. I think the Australians have the most boring food on the face of the earth, and they seem to have no national pride about their food. You ask someone in Melbourne, you know, where the good restaurants are, and he will invariably point you to either a Chinese place or an Italian place or a Spanish cooking. There seems to be no indigenous Australian food.
Kangaroo.
Well, I suppose that might be.
Yes.
And for a nation that's very proud of their country and their natural resources, and because there's a great deal to like and admire in Australia, but I found the food was just something they overlooked completely.
That's interesting that you say that, because at the top of this program you said that you started out with very plain, sensible cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that if the Australian food is dull, you're saying it's plain.
It just doesn't look like anything. It looks
it's gray.
It's gray, right. It's just gray.
Well, thank you, Tony. I've enjoyed hearing some of your opinions on food. My guest has been Tony Perkins, star of The Star-Spangled Girl. Now let's get down to business about carpets for business. Lee's Mark Royal, the commercial carpet with a handcrafted look. Business carpets have to be durable. Mark Royal is made to stay springier, bouncier, livelier, longer. It's made with pile of Orlon 33 acrylic by DuPont.
Springier, bouncier, it's a carpet fiber that's livelier. Springier, livelier, made by DuPont, it's Orlon 33.
For business or pleasure, it's those heavenly carpets by Lee's.
Listen again next weekend when Orlon 33 from DuPont and James Lee's Carpets again present Arlene Francis. Carmichael and the orchestra with Via Veneto. You're tuned to monitor your best bet for weekend entertainment wherever you are, at home or in your car or anywhere around the country. In and around San Antonio, Texas, we're heard on WOAI. Right now, I'll tell you what, let's just step aside, if we may, for a word from all our NBC stations, and then we'll be back with more of, well, I guess you could call it Monitor 67.
Monitor your Sunday night companion at home or away on the NBC Radio Network.
Hello. This is Monitor. I'm your host, Brad Crandall, and just ahead, today's latest sports news with Mel Allen. Right after we hear from the U.S. Double Quartet singing Life is Groovy. At the Monitor Sports Desk now, Mel Allen, with Today in Sports, plus a look at the week ahead.
Thank you very much, Brad. Hello there, everybody. Chuck Passerell and Mrs. Billie Jean King, the defending champions, retained their national indoor tennis titles. Passerell beat Arthur Ashe, America's top-ranked player, 13-11, 6-2, 2-6, 9-7, to become the first repeat men's winner in 31 years. Mrs. King had a much easier time. Took only 32 minutes to polish off Holland's Trudy Groneman, 6-1, 6-love. And by the way, the Ivy League champion will be able to play in the NCAA basketball tournament under terms of an interim agreement announced tonight by both organizations. There had been a dispute over minimum academic requirements. In automobile racing, Cincinnati's Ralph Latham drove a 1965 Plymouth to victory in the Daytona 250. Ted Webb will have the details on Sport of Speed later on today. For the first time in 15 years, Russia's domination of the Women's World Speed Skating Championships was ended. Hollenstein Kaiser won the overall title, but the big surprise was the performance of a virtually unknown American girl, Diane Hollum of Northbrook, Illinois, who at 15, the youngest entry in the 12-nation field, finished third overall. At Lake Placid, a United States Air Force team of Gary Sheffield and brakeman Howard Seiler flashed a victory in the National AAU Bobsled Championships. But after negotiating the tricky Mount Van Hovenberg course, their sled tipped over, sending Sheffield to the hospital with minor injuries. As Jimmy Hetlow said, it happens every time. Looking ahead, tomorrow, the National Football League opens its annual meetings in Honolulu, and welterweight champion Curtis Cokes takes on Ted Whitfield in a non-title bout in Dallas. Tuesday, the world champion Baltimore Orioles open spring training for pitchers and catchers in Miami. The $60,000 Milwaukee Professional Bowling Tournament begins. Thursday, two golf tournaments. The Philippine Open, the Panama Open. Friday, the Eastern Scholastic Swimming Championships at Lawrenceville, New Jersey, and two track meets, the Maple Leaf Games in Toronto and the Met Intercollegiates in New York. Saturday, the $100,000 Santa Anita Handicap, the $75,000 added Hialeah Turf Handicap, the All-Eastern Invitational Track Meet in Baltimore, the USA-Mexico Amateur Boxing Dual Meet, and the Canadian Centennial International Skiing Jumping Championships at Camp Fortune, Quebec. Sunday, the 500-mile Daytona Auto Race. That's what is and will be in sports, Brad. Mel Allen here, friends, reminding you that for more features and news from the world of sports, stay tuned to Monitor.
Now more monitor music from a native of our 50th state. Here's Don Ho, champagne glass in hand, singing Tiny Bubbles.
Tiny bubbles, airplane, make me happy, make me feel fine. Tiny bubbles, make me warm all over. Well, feeling that good, I love you till the end of time. So here's to the golden moon, and here's to the silver sea, and mostly here's a toast to you and me. Tiny bubbles,
tiny bubbles,
if the class will please come to order, I'd like to ask a question. Do you know what this is?
This is your NBC station. This is the pulse of the nation. For news and music, for something confused into NBC.
And this, we may add, is Monitor, where just ahead we'll be hearing from a man who claims to have talked with a creature from outer space. Stay right here. You're on the Monitor Beacon.
WNBC New York, the big voice of Big Town USA, is the sound of conversation.
Brad Crandall here, back again for Monitor. Unidentified flying objects continue to make news in this country, with more sightings reported during the past year than ever before. Reporter Long John Neville has interviewed literally hundreds of people with stories of seeing these mysterious objects in the sky. Recently, he talked with one George Adamski, who claims not only to have seen a flying saucer, but to have talked with one of its passengers.
George Adamski, I wonder if you could describe this man in detail to us.
A man was up there and waving to me. So I come up to this fella, and he had a funny suit on him, sort of a ski-type suit. The man, about a 5 foot, seven to eight inches, quite delicate hands, the tapered fingers, and beautiful, very sharp eyes, looked like they looked right through you. Sometimes you couldn't hardly tell whether he was really a man or a woman. And his long hair waving, resting on his shoulders, he kind of a halfway smile, and put his hand out to shake. And it was a palm-to-palm contact that way, and he smiled. I want to know where he's from. I pointed to the sun, and I made one orbit, called it Mercury, named it, and then Venus, and then Earth, and pointed it on myself and the Earth. And then I said, where are you from? He got the idea. He finally pointed to the sun, and he made one orbit, didn't say nothing. He made a second orbit, and he pointed to himself and to that orbit. Then that meant Venus. That's how I knew he was Venetian.
But he couldn't talk to you.
He could talk. He was testing my ability of receiving impressions, he told me later. So he did understand everything I said, except I didn't understand.
When you say impressions, are you referring to telepathic communication?
That's correct. All information we received silently. While we were standing there, trying to get some understanding between us, I saw a flash of lights go out, and I wonder where that come from, just like a mirror would do reflections, you know. And I looked around fast, and that's when I spotted the ship that I photographed was hiding in this little cove. And I pointed to him, and I said, "That's your ship." That's what I said. He nodded his head, and we walked all of 75 to maybe 90 feet from where we stood to this place. And that's where it finally told me to stay away from the ship, not get too close to it. It's unpowered. There was somebody else in it. You could see it, you know, shadow. Somebody else in it. But talking, I forgot all about it. And I somehow pushed over, and this arm got caught under the flange, and the magnetic force, or whatever you want to call it, pulled it up suddenly and slammed it back down. And even now, unaware, sometimes this arm goes limp. He finally went in the ship, went up this hill, see, and went up on the flange there in a door, and he went in there, and the way she took off, she went towards his mothership. Later, I've learned how they get in and out. They have hatches at the bottom, or they come out through the side, which is certain, what appear to be portholes, certain openings there. They can come right out of the side or out of the bottom. They usually return on the top, like a flat top, like a carrier, and then slide in down the chute.
Well, as unbelievable as it sounds, that's the way George Adamski told the story to me.
The man didn't say, by the way, when he saw this creature from Venus, but I kind of got a feeling it was New Year's Eve. Now, Margaret Whiting with more monitor music. The song, Just Like a Man.
Oh, he walks like a man, and he talks like a man, and he looks like a man, and he feels just like a man should. He's got hands like a man, and he stands like a man. He's got hips like a man, and he moves just like a man should.
Monitor's man on the aisle, Leonard Probst, takes a look at the current American engagement of the Bristol Old Vic Repertory Company and talks with its young star, Jane Asher.
The British Repertory Company, the Bristol Old Vic, is now on its first tour of the United States, taking in 17 cities in 17 weeks. The company's best-known actress is a 20-year-old redhead named Jane Asher. You may have seen her in the movie Alfie. She's the one who keeps scrubbing the floor and ironing shirts. She is very pretty, very direct, and is attracting an unusually young audience to the theater. Even before the Bristol Old Vic began its American tour last month in Boston, 32 girls requested interviews with Jane Asher. The reason is that Jane Asher is widely reported to be the girlfriend of Paul McCartney of the Beatles. The Bristol Old Vic opened here this week with Measure for Measure, followed by Hamlet. This Tuesday night will be the opening night when Jane Asher plays Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. I asked her if people are coming to see the company who ordinarily aren't interested in Shakespeare.
I think a lot of them are coming because there's been, the sort of teenage magazines over here have written quite a lot about me because of all sorts of connections. And they are coming, yes, that's true, because they take such an interest in anyone they read about in these magazines. But I don't really mind because they seem to go out after having seen it, having enjoyed it, which is, in a way, a sort of triumph for Shakespeare, that he can still excite very young people, you know, who've never seen him before.
They come to see a beetle and they get a bard.
Yes.
Let's go to Romeo and Juliet. How long have you played that part?
Well, with the Bristol Old Vic, I've only played it for, I suppose, 4 or 5 months, something like that. But I did it 5 years ago in England, on television.
You've been playing the role of Juliet for 5 years. You started when you were 15.
Well, I did it when I was 15. I haven't been playing it ever since.
Do I remember correctly that she's supposed to be 17?
14.
14?
Mm.
So, is there a right age for an actress to play Juliet?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think there was something fairly good about doing it at 15 because I was so close to her age. But on the other hand, you've got to be a lot older than that to do the second half of the play, which is so hard. There just isn't a perfect age, I don't think.
How do you see Juliet?
Well, I do it as realistically as possible. I think this is, I feel it's the only way to play Shakespeare. I think if you get poetic and too sort of romantically beautiful, it's all lovely, it does become boring, or it can do. I think if you play it realistically and try and become the character as much as you can, then the poetry speaks for itself. It's so well written. You don't need to sort of play it for the poetry.
Do you move differently from a non-realistic character?
Well, you know how some people would act Shakespeare very sort of
pompous.
Yes, stylized.
Stylized.
Yes. In that way, I suppose I don't move in a stylized way, I don't think. I don't probably move as I do in everyday life because I'm not like Juliet, I don't think, especially. But,
What do you mean you're not like Juliet?
Well, I'm not. I can't imagine committing suicide for a start. I haven't got that much strength of character.
Let me go back one step to something you said that I think is very valid, that you are now being interviewed by a number of people, but yet you have the feeling that what you say won't be taken straight.
Well, I don't know. I just get the feeling that everyone is dying to sort of find something ghastly I've said or to criticize me or, you know, and I must admit, I don't enjoy doing interviews and things because it's frightening. And you have to do them because I want the company to do well, obviously. And we need publicity to get bookings, let's face it. But I get sort of a bit panicky because, well, everything in America is that much faster than in England. And you find yourself sort of answering questions and making decisions very quickly. And it's so easy to give the wrong impression. It really is. If one could sort of sit down and talk to everyone over a long period of time and sort of quietly and not feel that you're being taped or you're being broadcast or whatever it is, I think people might get to know you a bit better and what's the real you.
Jane Asher, an actress very much on the level, who makes her first big attack on Broadway this Tuesday night. Leonard Probst, NBC News, New York. That's it from Broadway.
Now at the Twin 88s for Andy and Dicer with A Man and a Woman. Now, this message from your heart fund. In the midst of the greatest abundance this country's ever known, Americans are faced with a health problem, heart and circulatory disease. You can help Your Heart Association fight this number one killer by supporting Your Heart Fund. What you give is a personal investment in the kind of medical research that will eventually bring heart and circulatory disease under control. Bigger dividends in prevention and treatment depend on you. Give so more may live. You're tuned to Monitor. I'm your host, Brad Crandall, reminding you that NBC News on the Hour is coming up, and then we'll be back.
Ted Webb covers the exciting world of auto racing, the sport of speed, tonight on the NBC Radio Network.